Okay. I have to say that I'm very impressed with the previous talks. In fact, they covered so much of what I was going to say that I had to sit here scribbling new slides. And I'm not exactly sure how this will come out. But I have a number of points which I think are different from what other people have said, and I really want to bring that out. What I'm going to say is actually fairly controversial, but I don't want to disparage particularly what was said in the last talk. When it comes down to the problem of making a mix in 5.1, there's amazing things you can do, and the results can be absolutely terrific. And we all know in mixing in stereo that you can make some fabulous recordings. But why this is true, I don't know, because if you look at the process of stereo recording or mixing from the point of view of binaural theory, it shouldn't work. And the fact that it does is kind of amazing, but I want to compare it to what happens with natural hearing, and the comparison is not favorable. And I want to bring that out. And I'm also very glad that Professor Blauert is here, because he can correct me if I do something really stupid. In any case, let's go on. And before I'm going to do that, I'm going to make a little experiment. I'm using the microphone here now, and I actually have a very strong speaking voice, and I want to turn it off, and I want to see if you find it actually easier to understand me, or perhaps a better way to say it is harder to ignore me if I don't use the microphone. It is usually my experience that the natural voice has a kind of attention-grabbing quality that's actually lost when you use something like this. So if you think it was better with the microphone on, can you raise your hand? Oh, all right. Didn't work in this room. Okay, enough of that. I'll put it back on if I can figure out how to do it. Yeah, okay, sorry. We'll use the microphone, but I'm going to do my audio demonstrations with a speaker in a different way. I'm starting with the first slide, and I'm going to have to go fairly fast here, and I'm not going to get through the whole talk, so we'll just have to take it as it comes. I just want to make the point that sound localization in natural hearing is heavily weighted toward the frequencies of vocal formants. Now, you know the information in a vowel is all carried in this frequency range by the different strengths of critical bands in that range. And in fact, you don't need all of this stuff to understand speech. And you can see that evolution has blessed us with the attenuation of that. So actually, our hearing has filtered away all these pesky low frequencies that we don't actually need to understand what we're hearing. That's very important. Keep that in mind, because mostly audio engineers think about the spectrum as being fairly flat. But in fact, to the ear, that's not what's going on. Okay. What's interested me most in the last 5 years or so is how we actually can hear. Namely, if there's a complex audio scene, several instruments playing at the same time, several people speaking at the same time, in the presence of reverberation, we can hear them all independently. We can actually decide, I'm going to listen to the second violin. And you can do that, okay? But how can you do that? It's extraordinary. Let me go back to this drawing here. The difference between the sound and the localization of the second violin and the first violin is all carried in these frequencies. You can't tell the difference in timbre between a violin and a viola unless you have these frequencies clear. Okay, that's where the information is. If the violin and the viola are playing at the same time, how can you possibly do that? Because the critical bands in this range are like a third octave or wide or so, and you'd expect the formants to blend together, and you'd get a mixture of violin and viola and not be able to tell which was playing. But you can easily tell which is playing. So something else is going on. Okay, what I'm suggesting here is that at formant frequencies, the fact that we can hear the way we do means that you can separate these sounds one from another, and the only way you can do that is through pitch. Okay? So the fact that the violin is playing a different pitch than the viola means that you can separate the two. If they both play the same note at the same pitch, they do blend together, and you can't tell them apart. Okay? Now, that's really interesting. This data is actually rather old. It's from the 80s. Again, Blauert can correct me. That Huthma found that two people speaking in a monotone at the same time can be separately understood if their pitch is only different by half a semitone. That's 3%. That's huge. I mean, that's amazing, right? And I have some examples I'll play you in a minute of separating pitch by a whole semitone, which is a little bit easier. What I've found, and what I would like to suggest is the truth here, is that source separation and the perceived distance of a source and the clarity of localization and the clarity of sound are all related to the same physics. And they're related to the physics of sound in this frequency range. Okay. So let's go on to it. I want to show an example of speech, and here's where I'd like you to turn the speakers to mono, so this will only get reproduced on one speaker, if you will. This is an impulse response. It's rather short. It happens to be all pass. Okay, so it has no net effect on the spectrum. And I'm going to play some speech through it, and when I click it, this part of the speech is without, it's just the way I recorded it from microphone. This part of the speech has been passed through this all-pass filter, and the difference in sound is absolutely extraordinary, and I want you to hear it. If I record my voice with a microphone close to my mouth, the sound is very close to the ear of the listener, present, very clear. However, if I scramble the harmonics above 1,000 hertz, the sound is very different. It might be perceived as distant or muddy. Okay, just for fun, can you turn on both speakers and let me play that again? And try to remember what it sounded like before it was scrambled and see what it sounds like with two speakers instead of one.
If I record my voice with a microphone close to my mouth, the sound is very close to the ear of the listener, present, very clear. However, if I scramble the harmonics above 1,000 hertz, the sound is very different. It might be perceived as distant or muddy.
All right, up here on the stage, I couldn't tell the difference between the first half and the second half. I assume you probably did better than that. But the point is, when you start reproducing a coherent sound through two loudspeakers at the same time, you can get into real trouble with clarity. That was the point I was trying to make. All right, so I'll talk more about that in a sec. The difference is, between those two speeches that I just gave, is the difference is that the phase relationships of the harmonics in the vocal formant range have been scrambled. Okay, and I'm making the point here that it's really important that you preserve the phases of those upper harmonics or you get a big difference in clarity. And this is a new idea for some people, not for others. I'm going to go a little bit further with this. I'm going to play a few more demonstrations. Incidentally, I came to the conclusion watching the other talks that I'd do a lot better if I talked less and played more sounds. So I immediately added all these slides in. So you're going to be subjected to sounds, at least for a bit. All right, I'm going to do that speech again, only I'm going to speak in a monotone at the pitch of C below middle C, okay?
I am speaking in a monotone at a pitch of C.
Just one speaker.
Although it may sound a bit odd, it is easy to understand every word. Now the question is...
Oops, I missed the pitch there. Sorry about that. Now I'm going to remove all the frequencies below 1,000 hertz, and I'm showing here on the picture that they're really gone. I mean, they're really gone, okay? I really got rid of them all. And the point is, if I play this, you'll still hear the pitch just as well as if the frequencies were there. Can you raise the level? Ready? Here we go. The answer is maybe not in this reverberant room, but in headphones, it's trivial. Not trivial. It takes a little practice. But once you learn how to do it, it's easy. But this is a semitone. It's not Chutzma who wanted half a semitone. What happens in a room, okay? Here's a measured impulse response of a small concert hall. Only this was measured with an omnidirectional speaker like that one, only about a third of the size. And I raised the level of the direct sound 6 dB because I said, oh my God, it sounds so bad. It's not a good demonstration. Anyway, a speaker has certain directivity, so that's sort of fair. Now I'm going to play exactly the same demonstration here, but with the room added. Again, keep it just one speaker, please. All right, you can still understand it, right? Not easily, but you can. I'm going to play the C-sharp one. Okay. Now I'm going to play them both together. Okay, that's enough of that. You can't tell that apart. There's no way, even in headphones. They're mixed together. There's no way you can tell them apart. What I'm trying to show here is that adding room response, particularly below beyond a certain amount of reflections, you lose the ability to separate sounds. You can no longer do it by pitch or any other means. Now, when they don't overlap, you can do it. And so when your brain says, oh, I hear the violin, and for the moment, you'll always hear the violin in that spot. And if you're watching a violin play, you can tell what notes they're playing, okay, if you're good at it. But that doesn't mean you're hearing it. If you went in there and shut your eyes, would you be able to hear them? No. Would you be able to tell where they were? No, actually, because it's gone. They're mixed together, you can no longer tell. Here's an example of that. This is a binaural example. I don't know if it will work in this room. Both speakers, please. But this was a string quartet I recorded in row F, which was actually behind the lady in red here. And the quartet subtends maybe plus or minus 7 degrees. I say 10 degrees here. Maybe it is really 10 degrees. Somewhere between 10 and degrees. But you realize that to be able to hear each instrument in that string quartet, you're going to have to be able to localize them with an accuracy of 3 degrees or better. And you can. If you listen to this recording with headphones, the quartet is absolutely localizable all the time. You hear each instrument, you can choose to listen to which one, whatever. Okay, that's enough of that. Now I'm going to move 5 rows further back. And everybody says, well, what's different about that 5 rows further back? The answer is nothing. There was no acoustic feature which changed. The only thing that changed was the direct-to-reverberant ratio. One of the more perceptive of my audience members, when I did this at the AES, said, "Ooh, it sounds like they just moved into a bathtub." I don't know if that's audible here, but the difference in sound is absolutely enormous. And it's the same microphones, the same players. I know it's playing a different piece. And I simply moved back 5 seats. The difference in direct-to-reverberant ratio is maybe a dB, maybe a dB and a half. And it moved from perfectly localizable to completely soup. All right, and that's what happens when the phases of harmonics get changed. All right, perception of reverberation and envelopment. The goal of the ear brain is to extract meaningful sound objects from a confusing acoustic field. To the brain, reverberation is a form of noise. Got it? It's very pleasant noise, but it's noise. Where possible, the brainstem separates direct sound from reverberation, forming 2 distinct sound streams. One of the foreground, the notes, and one of the reverberation that note engenders. My point is that perceiving reverberation and envelopment as such is only possible when the direct sound can be separated from the reverberation. That means that the clarity of the front image is a vital part of hearing envelopment. If you can't detect clearly the front image as separate from the reverberation, then the two blend together and you can only hear a mixture of the two, and it's not enveloping. You can hear that in that binaural recording I just made. When it's pea soup, the reverberation is all in front. When you can localize the instruments, it's enveloping all around you. These facts are generally unappreciated in current concert hall design, and that's why I'm making this kind of research. It's really a concert hall problem, because invariably in a recording, the front image is clear. Why? Because the recording engineer knows from experience that if the front image isn't clear, no one will buy it. Well, they do buy it in concert halls, and I don't really know why. In concert halls, a well-blended sound is sometimes preferred by people, and I expect that's because they'd really rather be taking a nap. It need not be so. With good acoustic design, a concert conceit can have better clarity and envelopment than any recording reproduced over loudspeakers. I've got wonderful binaural recordings that demonstrate it. This string quartet is one of them. When you listen to it at the good seat, it's great. It's really nice. Okay, how do we localize sound in natural hearing? We know that we localize sounds through the interaural level difference and the interaural time delay. And experiments with sine tone show that ITD is not particularly useful above 2 kilohertz due to the frequency limit of nerve firings. Now, a week ago, I thought that you could actually detect timing information further up than 2 kilohertz. But I fairly recently proved myself that you can't. Well, so much for my theory. But anyway, that seems to be true. But high harmonics in the 1 kilohertz to 4 kilohertz range of that are harmonics of low frequency tones that are in the high range contain nearly all the information of speech. I just demonstrated that to you. And they also provide the timbre cues that identify musical instruments and vowels. When these harmonics are present, we find we can localize tones by the interaural level difference. And the interesting thing is if you're using the harmonics to localize tones, the head shadowing is very large. There's huge head shadowing above 2 kilohertz, okay? So the acuity, the reason you have such good acuity, for example, hearing that string quartet concert and localizing these instruments that are only a few degrees apart, is because you're using ILD information at high frequencies, and that ILD information is available in the harmonics. Okay. To understand the ability to localize speech and music, we need to use signals that include harmonics. Almost all the data on this kind of localization is done with side tones, or perhaps with noise bands. Those are not the kind of signals the ear actually uses. That's my opinion. When harmonics are present, our ability to localize is extremely acute, 2 degrees or better. And I'll show you why. Here's the MIT Keymar data. Can you see the purple curve? It's actually a little dim. Here, you can see that the difference between the purple curve and the blue curve is 2 dB, and sometimes a little bit more above about 1,000 hertz. It's really amazing how much that is. Okay, now if you assume the threshold for difference localization in human hearing is 1 dB, I actually think it's better than that. Blauer can convince me otherwise, but it's typical. Threshold difference between two signals at the ears causes an image shift, and 1 dB is a lot, then we would be able to predict that people can hear accurately to 2 degrees, and that's in fact what people measure, that's known. So that's how you're localizing things, okay? Now, the question is, what happens if you have, I've been talking about speech or via single violin or something, if you have a section that gets more complicated, I'm actually going to skip this slide because I want to go on. Summary of natural hearing. When early reflections are not too strong, we're able to localize multiple sound sources with high precision, approximately 2 degrees. If multiple people are talking simultaneous, we are able to choose to listen to any of them. If multiple instruments are playing at the same time, we're able to follow the lines of several at the same time. And all these abilities disappear abruptly when the early reflections exceed a certain level with respect to the direct sound. This they almost never do in a recording, but they do it all the time in concert halls. Why don't they do it in a recording? Because you can hear it, and engineers don't do something so stupid. Okay? All right. Now, but the next thing I want to say, which is actually important, and that is localization in natural hearing is independent of frequency. If I play noise bands at a certain angle in a binaural setup, and we change, you know, we go through different noise bands from the same position. The ear thinks they're all in the same position, okay? But that's not true in stereo. And I have this thing at the bottom here, which you can read. It's all right. What happens in stereo? Stereo recordings manipulate the position of image sources between two loudspeakers by varying either time or level. My test has always been, well, let's put a source halfway between center and left and see what we get. Okay. If we listen to this kind of thing with headphones, if we have a pan pot, I'm going to use a pan pot here. If we use a pan pot and listen with headphones, it works just fine, except that the image goes 30 degrees to the right or the left instead of 15 because the earphones sort of pan from 90 degrees to 0 to 90 degrees. And in the front image here, we're only going plus or minus 30 degrees. All right. But the fact is, if we set a pan pot so it's supposed to be there, and we listen to a broadband source like speech, it's always perceived as here, which means the pan law is not working. Well, why is that? Well, the fact is that sound is diffracting around the head, you see. We've heard a lot about that already. And what happens is it gets attenuated at high frequencies somewhat, and it also gets time delayed, and we know that too. Now, at some frequency, and it happens to be about 1600 hertz, the time delay is sufficient to switch the phase of this to 180 degrees away from the phase of that. All right, well, what happens with that? Well, you have two speakers. You have this coming and you have that coming. If the diffraction, if you've got something here, if this speaker is strong, that speaker is weak. In fact, this speaker is 0.91 and this speaker is 0.38. That's sine cosine of 22.5 degrees. So this the signal here is about 10 dB down, well, 9 dB down compared to this. And the diffraction around the head at 1600 hertz is about 6 dB. So what happens is that you've got a lot of sound going here 180 degrees away from the sound that's coming from here, and they're going to interfere with each other. And at some frequency, they're going to completely cancel each other. So this ear is going to hear nothing, and this ear is going to have lots of level. So you're going to localize it 90 degrees to the left, right? That's what happens. So this is actually measured data. This is a sine cosine pan where this is plus or minus 45 degrees on the speaker and not 30. And you'd expect the sine cosine pan to come out. Well, that basically works at low frequencies. But as frequencies go up, the image shifts dramatically to the left. Okay, and that the peak of that is about 1600 hertz, as I said, I think. Yeah, it works out about right. Maybe a little bit lower on this head. Okay. Anyway, that's really extraordinary. It means that if you're panning a speaker, a sound halfway between center and left, and it's really true that the ear is using primarily these frequencies to localize, then you're right in the middle of this graph. And where the hell, I mean, where, wrong graph here. This graph. So where the hell are you going to localize it? That depends on, of course, the content, frequency content of the signal. And for speech, it comes out about here. Okay. Well, does this matter in sound recording? Not really, because no engineer sets a pan pot by what angle it's supposed to be. They listen to it, right? So you adjust the pan pot till the image comes in the right place and everybody's happy and go home. But what really matters here is that if you have competing things going on at the same time, you have other instruments playing, reverberation, whatever, it becomes very hard to tell where it is because you really don't know what the ear is using as its frequency reference. And so images become rather cloudy, particularly with a lot of things going on. Question is, if you're using ORTF and there's some delay panning, how much more time do I have? Anybody give me an answer? Zero?
No, 7.
Huh?
7 minutes?
Oh, that's great. I'll speed through. Okay, if you're using delay panning, it's even worse. Okay, this is octave band data. Again, I set this was 30 plus minus 30 degrees on the speakers. I set the low frequencies for 15 degrees, that is to say halfway between center and left. And then this is a 200 microsecond delay, which is exactly what you would expect to give you a 15-degree shift in localization by binaural theory. But as you go up in frequency, oh gosh, look what happens.
The actual position of the image goes well beyond the loudspeaker axis and heads toward 90 degrees.
So I'm just saying stereo is an illusion based on fuzzy data. And it seems rather good because the brain does not like ambiguity. And once it decides where an image is likely to be, it keeps it there regardless of the data that it's getting. Our perception of sharp images between center and left or right is really just an illusion. And it's based on the brain's willingness to guess. What happens if we reproduce that over headphones? As I said before, over headphones, you don't get this frequency dependence. And so headphones can reliably spread an image plus or minus 90 degrees, and the frontal accuracy is about 2.5 degrees. And that's with PanPot. So you can use set a PanPot in headphones and really get a sharp image. It's possible to hear precisely local image from PanPots, but not with speakers. But I have to emphasize that headphone reproduction requires that you have accurate equalization of the headphones. Ideally, they have to be individually different for the left and the right ear. Some people's hearing is sufficiently symmetric that they can get a sharp image on headphones, really sharp image. I mean, it has to be like 2 degrees to really get it good. But that really almost always requires individual equalization. And the only way to do that right is to measure it at the eardrum. I was just at Helsinki talking with the Ville Pulkki's group, who's actively working on this, trying to say, can you get accurate equalization with blocked ear canal measurements? And the answer is, if you use a very open headphone, it might be true. If you use an on-ear or a closed-form headphone, the answer is it's not true at all. You have to measure at the eardrum for most kinds of headphones. Coincident microphones produce a signal similar to a pan pot, but the range is limited. If you have two cardioids, say, at 90 degrees, Gunter showed this, the center image is all pushed into the center. You don't get widespread. If you use two supercardioids at 110 degrees, then you get perfect localization around the whole loudspeaker axis. But nobody does this for reasons I don't know. I guess it's because everybody started using cardioids, and when good supercardioids came out, it was just something else that nobody really figured out how to do. So to produce a full left or full right signal, you have to have the null of one microphone on the peak of the other. That's obvious. Okay, let's keep going on. I make lots and lots of recordings where I compare sound field and binaural. I have a sound field microphone here in this position, and this binaural dummy has my own ears and my own ear canals. It's a pretty much exact replica of my hearing. And when you compare the two with headphones, the sound field always has a narrower front image. That is, it doesn't separate sounds as well. That because the dummy head is actually much more frequent or directional selective at high frequencies than the sound field is. Sound field is at best crossed figure of eights, and if you're using coincident hypercardioids, give a image JND of about a little bit more than five degrees. And crossed figure of eights give 3.3 degrees, and head gives better than 2. And it's really obvious in the image. The other thing with the sound field is there's more reflected energy because there's no head shadowing. Interestingly, the fact that you have head here blocks the reverberation from this side from hitting that ear, and it blocks the reverberation from this side for hitting this ear. So the direct-to-reverberant ratio is actually much higher in a dummy head than it is in any full surround type of microphone. Ambisonics versus wave field synthesis. I don't want to say a lot about this because it's a very complicated issue. But in most ambisonic recording, there's a real problem with head shadowing. Most people who measure ambisonic systems use a point microphone, and they show that, oh, there's this perfect reconstruction over some very small area. And if you put a dummy head in that area, the whole thing breaks down because there's head shadowing in there, and it really changes the way it works. A very high-order ambisonics where the area of perfect reconstruction was considerably larger than a dummy head might work, but I think you have to go to, like, 12th order before that actually happens. The result is that everything seems further away because the result of that is the ambient information is increased compared to the front image. And Gerson knew about this, but the solutions aren't particularly good about it. Wave field synthesis, the problem with that is that the frequencies of most importance are 1,000 to 4,000 hertz, and that's where spatial aliasing kills you.
So unless you go to a really smooth speaker thing, you've got trouble there too. So let's go to 5.1 and then we'll wrap it up. Perceiving is discrete. We know all about this. You know all about this. Okay? So let's skip that. Vertical localization. Vertical localization, and Blauer can tell me that's right, wrong, is achieved entirely through timbre cues maybe 500 and up. Okay? You just don't have any vertical timbre cues available, which means that if you wanted to do this thing with height, you don't need big speakers. Okay? Anything that will reproduce reasonable level above 500 hertz will do. And you can stick it to the ceiling with double stick tape or something. It's not a big deal. You don't have to have one of these speakers hanging from the ceiling. That's really, from binaural theory, it's totally unnecessary. You can prove me wrong if you wish. And when I was doing experiments with this before, all you need is decorrelated signals from that speaker, and you can get that any number of ways. You don't really have to record them. All right, conclusions. Localization in natural hearing takes place mostly at frequencies above 1,000 hertz and has a precision of approximately 2 degrees in the horizontal plane. And you can reproduce that over headphones from binaural recording if you fix the earphone problems, which is where the real problems are. Commonly used pressure gradient microphone techniques are not capable of capturing sound direction with this precision. The best they can do is about 4 degrees. And techniques that use cardioid microphones give at best 8 degrees or so. And the problem there is that the localization over loudspeakers is so terribly frequency dependent. Multi-channel reproduction in 5.1 improves the accuracy by about a factor of 2. I calculated that the night before last just so I could say it. But if you have 3 speakers in front, these frequency dependent effects go down about a factor of 2, and the sharpness of that image at all frequencies increases by about a factor of 2. So it's really a good idea to use left, center, right panning if you really want a sharp image. And if you really want a sharp image, 5 channels in the front is definitely the way to go. Okay, and that's it. So I stop. Okay, I hope that wasn't too in your face. Somebody can take me to task. Please raise your hand. Oh, Blauer, let's start with him.
I have a very simple thing today. Your first slide where you try to explain the sensitivity of the hearing organ,
yes,
by the transfer function of the audio and middle ear.
Well, that's a start, right?
Yeah, okay, well, at middle levels, the isophones are flat, so somehow the ear compensates for it.
I don't think that's my experience.
The isophones for very low levels are just inverted from what you showed.
Yes, that's right. At higher levels, they level out. But not according to the ISO equal loudness curves. There is still a very substantial reduction in threshold. It's about 6 decibels. It's not as big as you see here, but it's not dissimilar.
If you go to 80 decibels, it's almost
better. To 80 decibels?
Yeah, well, that's
I don't know. I have a slide with the ISO equal loudness curves. I think I can show it to you later. but they don't. It doesn't disappear. It does get flatter. No doubt about it.
There are more questions?
Yes.
I have two questions. First, really great. Thank you. I have 2 questions. The first one is related to localization and why it is an illusion. Frequencies above 2 kHz, as Mr. Flower already mentioned, is the spot where we are most sensitive in, and this is exactly the spot where we should neither with the interaural level nor with the interaural time delay be able to localize, right? But in fact, we can do that even if we have loudspeakers. So therefore, this leads me to the thinking. Probably the frequency domain below 1,500 hertz is the most dominant one.
Well, I completely disagree with the first statement. You can localize extremely well above 2 kHz. You can try it sometime. Just try a 2 kHz noise band with natural hearing.
Yeah.
Not in loudspeakers, but with natural hearing.